Welcome to a special edition of Bridging the Gap. I'm Judy Getty here with Bridging the Gap host Paul Thomas, who spent the weekend of May 4th in Talkeetna covering the Alaska Democratic Convention. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Judy.
What can you share with our listeners about what you learned in Talkeetna?
You know, first of all, I want to thank you for hosting this edition. And I tried to find out from the people attending the convention what they felt about the main issue regarding their involvement as political actors, as well as what they felt the group up in the convention needed to address. And so all my questions were basically one question, the same question. You know, what do you as a political actor feel is the main issue facing you and this group? And so whenever we go to those questions, we're just going to all remember, our listeners and you and me and Mike are all going to remember that that is the question I asked everybody.
Can you just tell me a little bit first about what did the crowd look like, about how many people were there?
It varied day to day. There were people that came in throughout the weekend, so it varied. The crowd was reasonably small. It wasn't a lot of people. I couldn't give you any numbers.
But you found
I tried to go into the convention hall at one point, and they booted me out because I wasn't credentialed as a delegate. So I couldn't do a head count.
So you were hanging around outside and then asking people that one question.
Right. Okay. But one of the things that I noticed about the thing that really kind of struck me, and I guess that's sort of the nature of these kind of gatherings, is that there is a tendency to get mired in minutiae. There was one particular point with the platform committee where they were discussing education, and they came up in the draft the phrase pre-K through 12, or I shouldn't say 3K through 12, pre-K hyphen 12.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the delegates there on the platform committee, members of the committee, made a serious objection to not having a hyphen after pre whenever he felt there needed to be one. And what really got me was the amount of time that was spent on the fact that we needed two hyphens in that phrase and how little was done, because that was the main focus of the discussion. And that's why I came up with the phrase mired in minutiae.
That does make sense. And you know, when that happened, there isn't an allowance for somebody to say, let's table that for right now and we can, you know, dig into these other things? Or?
There is, but there wasn't. The argument went on about it because I guess there was a feeling that it was important that they get it right. You know, and don't get me wrong, there were eyeballs rolling as the conversation devolved into that.
Mm-hmm.
But what can you do? This is the democratic process in action.
Everyone gets their say, but then they don't take a vote on it and just by consensus.
Oh, everything was voted on.
Okay.
Everything was voted on, but it went on and on. And that wasn't the only thing that caused me to feel that. I was at the time, I had to correct my papers because it was my final I gave at Mat-Su College, the last final I ever gave, was the day before, and I had a lot of work to do just to get the grades in. So I was sitting in the room with the platform committee at a table getting my work done, but I was listening to this.
You're multitasking.
Yes. I had to.
Well, it sounds like, yes, it was a good diversion to have something else to put your mind to. So do you want to tell us some of the answers that you did get? You know, were there any similarities with issues?
Well, there are not really many similarities. There was one point where the congressional candidates talked about health care a lot. That's about the only similarity I saw. Most of the people discussed things that were across the broad range. But instead of me telling you what they are, I'd like to let the speakers themselves, which I managed to record in interviews with them, speak to those.
Okay.
Sherry Olson spoke about the importance of voting beyond party lines.
Party over people. As soon as we headed in that direction to where party was more important than the citizens, than humanity, where party became more important than our water, our environment, problems, and as far as fishing and, you know, those types of things, we're going to have to take this earth, these earthly problems into consideration over our party.
Sarah Welton talked about planning and financial stability.
main issue is to elect people who will carry our message. And the message is that we need to be financially stable using sound practices. And that includes planning into the future so that we can be successful and not bankrupt our state.
Okay, now the financially stable aspect of it, Alaska is kind of in big trouble right now because that financial stability, at least in running state government, isn't there. Talking basically about revenue streams, so what's your proposal for establishing those revenue streams, or do you think we don't need to do that?
I'm not an economic guru. I don't know all of the ins and outs of the finances, but I do know that communities that plan and people who pay attention to their budgets do better than those that just say, well, this is what we need and we don't care about where the money's coming from. People who...
But where is the money going to be coming from?
Well, and that's the thing is... And I hate to go into the past, but, it was the late 80s, early 90s, Governor Cooper had proposed an education endowment that would take a couple $100 out of our permanent fund and put it into an endowment like a permanent fund for our schools. Right now, it would have been paying our education bills. It would have been supporting the education in the state. We didn't do that because people had to have their permanent funds. Well, now we've even cut our permanent funds in order to make the changes. We're not doing the investment piece to get the return. I believe in investing in Alaska. I don't have all the wherewithal, but I do believe that if we were to take some of the money and put it into an endowment specifically for education, since that's a major part of the state's budget, that we would do better in the future.
So you said that planning better is the major issue. Is there any other issues you think need to be addressed besides the planning better?
Well, understanding why we are a state and why we work to provide certain amenities to our constituents, to our people. I don't want to live in a state where our children are not cared for. I do not want to live in a state where we do not have decent roads and hospitals and public safety. I want to live in an area where it's healthy. Healthy communities require that we invest in them.
What hope do you have for the results of this particular gathering of Democrats in Talkeetna? After everybody leaves here on Sunday, what do you hope happens from what happened here today?
I hope that people are energized and to work in their communities. I hope that people who have been sitting on the fence will decide to get out and work. Volunteering in your community is the most important thing you can do, whether it's to actually help a candidate or whether it's just to clean up your neighborhood and help your public library. We need to be out there and we need to be doing the things as citizens. It's part of our obligation to the state and to our fellow citizens to work together.
Thanks, Sarah. Appreciate your input. Pat Chesbrough spoke to what happens when we continue to cut spending. Okay, Pat, we were talking earlier about taxation, right? And you say that the citizens of Alaska need to start being more responsible for the services that were provided by state government by paying their fair share in the taxes. The Republican talking points have been, all we have to do is cut spending. We don't have to raise taxes. We can actually cut, how do you respond to that particular point?
I think the idea that the way to, I used to work with a person that said the way to success is to cut? I don't think so. And I really worry. I come from a classroom, so I was a teacher for a long time. And I'll tell you that if you have 20 kids in a class, that's a lot different from having 30 or 35. And these little erosions that we have, we keep cutting, and then next year we cut a little bit more, and then next year we cut a little bit more. If you had a steak and you kept cutting off a little bit, you wouldn't have much by the time you got to the bone. And that's kind of where we are in Alaska. And I really feel like we need to change the word from taxation to investment. I think it's investment. We want companies to come here and invest. Why don't we feel that we can?
And the educational system is a good place to start that investment if we're talking about investing in the future. Right now, we're in the very middle, I believe, of a large teacher walkout sweep across the nation. Started in West Virginia, and now it's moved on to quite a few other states. Do you think Alaska's next?
Alaska could be next. We do not treat the teachers as well as we taught teachers as we treated teachers when I was a teacher. When I came to Alaska, we had a good benefit system. We worked hard. I'm not saying we didn't work hard. I still spent many, many hours teaching. It wasn't that. It's just that people felt like it was important to educate the kids and to have small enough classes where you could get to know the kids and to be able to know your subject matter. And we thought it was important in those days. And I don't know why we don't think it's so important anymore. It costs money and it costs valuable time. One of the things that I used to say when I was a school administrator was the amount of time we spend cutting budgets and then taking it back to somebody and cutting it again, those hours, those days could be spent actually trying to improve the lives of children and concentrate on curriculum and have smaller classrooms. But that is an expensive venture to cut the budget every year. And so I go back to dragging chairs in rooms, some of our classrooms were not even built for the number of students that they need to put in there now.
We just drag students around as well.
Yes, and it is... We're giving our students a message. We're giving our kids a message that they're not really very important.
Cooper Blankenship is a young man who spoke about the importance of this election and also gave a nice reminder of our civic responsibilities.
Well, I think that this election cycle has really high stakes. And I think for this convention, one of the biggest things that we need to figure out is like what can we do to ensure success in November so that we can face these high stakes that we're having in the country right now. I mean, the current administration, there are all kinds of problems and just driving deeper divisiveness into the country. So
some people would call them dangers.
Yeah. I think I would be one of those people as well, it's a dangerous climate right now in America, and it's creating a dangerous climate in the world. And obviously, we want to heal the divides we have in our country, but we also, there's sort of a more urgent, in my opinion, factor of domestic and national security that the current administration is certainly not helping and possibly contributing to. Yeah, I think taking back the House, taking back the Senate, at the very least having a check on the Trump administration will help in ways that I don't think we can quite comprehend just yet.
Well, with the three branches of government, that check was supposed to be legislative, judicial, and then, of course, the check on the executive, which it appears we need right now. So who do you think is most responsible for the lack of a check of the other two branches, judicial and legislative?
Congress, for sure. I think Ryan and McConnell are not doing their jobs. Well, I mean, there's so much posturing. There's so much, they're married to their ideas. They won't sit down and have conversations with the other party. That's kind of the point of a legislative branch, is to have a deliberative body that can all bring ideas to the table and pick the best ideas from them.
Jay Parmalee, executive director of the Alaskan Democratic Party, spoke at length on the election, candidates, and the economy.
Well, a couple things. I'm pretty excited about 2018 as an election year, and we still have not many, but we still have a few legislative districts where we don't have announced candidates yet. And the one big thing that I hope will come out of this convention is in those places that will either have some names or have people step forward because of the enthusiasm around the weekend, say, listen, I want to run. Because it's really important for us to field candidates.
Now, are these districts one where the Republicans have kind of had a stranglehold for the most part?
Most of them are. And most of our Democratic districts have, in some cases, multiple candidates. But in Republican, long-held Republican districts, there are some where we have candidates, but there are still a few where we need to find someone. But I feel like right now with this sort of it's national enthusiasm as well for the Democratic Party.
They call it the blue wave.
They do, but the question is, does the blue wave extend to Alaska? And I think it gets close. I think there is this feeling and this of excitement about real opportunities for us to win elections, and we're seeing that by in some of the most Republican districts where we have already have Democratic candidates step up, but we just need to find a few more. I think that's the real question. And this is a great year for us to give voters a real choice between the Democrats and the Republicans. It's a big, big election year.
Do you feel the issues are pretty distinctive?
I do. A couple things. I think for there are important national issues, but I think what overshadows this election year are Alaska issues specifically.
So what would you identify as an issue that is purely goes like partisan, Democrats this way? Realistically,
the big one is for Alaska right now is our still trying to solve our state's fiscal crisis, and the real line in the sand between the Democrats and the Republicans is the Republicans simply have refused to find a way to get new revenue into the state budget. And that's multiple ways. They've refused to raise taxes on oil companies. They have refused to cut. They think they can cut their way, or they've refused to talk about any kind of tax structure. Now, no one wants to talk about raising taxes, but you can't just sit around and depend on oil, even though it's rebounding. It's a slow process and will take a while. You can't just depend on that to solve its problems. And the Republicans have just said no, particularly the Republicans in the state Senate. The Democrats in the House and the Democratic-led House majority have put together, along with the governor, a real comprehensive fiscal plan that gets us out of this mess, still funds education, still funds public safety, and infrastructure, critical needs. Those are the three things that sort of our side says these are must-haves for Alaska. And I think that's the big difference. And that permeates sort of all of the elections throughout the state, particularly at the legislative level. It's like, what are we doing? Unemployment's up. More people are leaving than coming in. The economy's taking a hit. Even though it's doing better, it's still taking a hit.
Well, it's booming in the lower 48. Just today it came out 3.9%, and our unemployment is increasing. We're in recession up here.
We are, and that's, and that's not uncommon for oil-producing states to sort of be out of step with those that are not. And we're feeling sort of the pinch of this economic downturn, and that's the number one issue, I think, going into it. People may not talk about it. They may talk about it in terms of education funding or public safety needs or infrastructure needs, but what they really mean by that is we have to fix this fiscal situation we're in.
Kansas is going through the same, exactly same model, where they figure that we won't take any taxes from anybody, and that's going to be such a wonderful environment for commercial activity that everybody's going to come to our state. Does it work?
Clearly not working in Kansas from what we can tell.
Or Alaska.
No, it's not worked here either. So I think that that's not the best model, and I think most of our Democratic candidates are saying it's not the best model. And voters, you know, sometimes it just takes a while. Voters are complicated issues. They're tough issues. Voters don't want to hear the word taxes. They don't like to hear they're already struggling, right? They're some families are already struggling, so they don't want to really stop and think about, oh gosh, am I going to have to pay more? And it's only until schools start taking hits, teachers' class sizes get larger. It's only until public safety becomes a real problem, and it is a growing problem throughout much of Alaska. And it's all because of funding, and that's where it comes back to. And that's when voters sort of say, it's not like they wake up, but it's where they start saying, okay, if I want these things, then what are we going to have to do to fix it? And the Democrats are talking about comprehensive fiscal plan. They're talking about, you know, making the cuts where we need to, but also finding new areas of revenue and making hard budget decisions to get us out of this. And the Republicans are not. I mean, they're just not. They're saying, in fact, what the Republicans are saying is essentially they don't care about taking the PFD. They're happy to. They want to rob the permanent fund to just pay for government, quite frankly, and to cut it. Cut as much as they can, rob, take it away. No one else has to pay anymore. We're not going to worry about this, and we're going to hope and pray that the price of oil rebounds. Well, it is rebounding, but it's not rebounding fast enough.
I want you to put on your amateur economics hat now.
Sure.
And as I ask this question, is there a direct correlation between our state fiscal crisis that you've just expounded on and the recession we're experiencing now?
Sure. I mean, it's completely one for one. I mean, the state's fiscal crisis is brought about because of we've been in this really slow economic downturn, which has been less money that we brought in to fund government.
But there was no money being brought in from anywhere except the oil companies.
Correct.
Prior to that.
That's right. But remember, they were at this higher, much higher level when the price of oil was much higher. So, no, we are not as our economy is not as diverse as it needs to be to sustain a long-term sort of economic downturn. If one, when we are solely dependent on one industry and they take a hit, everybody takes a hit. So the more you can diversify, the more jobs you can bring, the more industry you can bring or create. And it's slow. It's more challenging in Alaska than in some other states. But I think that's the big difference. The Democrats are saying, listen, we have to find ways to diversify, at the same time make the oil companies pay their fair share, and we have to make really hard decisions about the budget until we get out of this fiscal crisis. But, you know, we're not going to be out of it in the next year. It's going to take a couple, 3 years to climb our way out. But you have to make decisions now to make that happen. You can't just keep waiting. Spending all of our reserves and hoping it gets better is not an answer.
How important is this election, this November, to that issue?
I think that's the critical mass, right? I think this election year, if we are able to win, pick up additional seats in the state legislature, both in the House and the Senate, then that's the key. And if we're not able to do that and it stays the same, then we're just going to get more of the same. It's not going to change. So this election is absolutely critical to advancing the cause of a what I call a comprehensive fiscal plan, making good, sound policy decisions to get Alaska out of this recession, at least get us out of this economic downturn that we've been in.
Let's move to national a little bit. We have three officials that are elected to our national legislature, two senators and Mr. Young. How does that look for the Democrats this fall?
So the only race on the ballot is our congressional seat. Don Young's the seat he currently holds and has held for over 40 years. We have three candidates running on our side right now, Lise Galvin, Dimitri Shane, and Greg Jones. And we're going to have a primary, and we're going to have a great candidate out of one of those three. And
when's the primary?
August 21st is the primary. And we'll have a good primary. Our candidates, they're going to be here this weekend. They've been traveling the state talking to as many voters as they can, and you'll hear a lot more from them as the summer moves on. But I think it'll be a great contrast to Don Young as we take him on in November, whoever the winner of our primary is.
Neil Lacy is running for State House in District 10. His main issues were the economy and education.
The most pressing issue for me as a candidate and hopefully to be elected to the State House is our economy. It's in a shambles. And along with education, spending, those are my two key issues that I want to work towards.
So education and the economy. The unemployment numbers just came out nationally, and they're down to 3.9% unemployment rate. How does that have any effect on Alaska?
Well, Alaska is a microcosm unto itself. We don't, the trends happen down south, happen here slowly, or they don't happen at all. We still have a high rate of unemployment in this state right now.
Now, one of the things that has occurred, and this is probably relevant to your aspiration as a candidate for State House, is the lack of a tax base since the oil dried up as far as providing revenue for our state government. Well, do you have any proposals or any suggestions on how that can be remedied?
Well, I want to say, first off, as a retired person, a person who owns his own house, I hate paying taxes, but we have to pay for basic services somehow. I'm not so sure that at this juncture we need a income tax. What we do need to do is quit wasting our money. And the Republican-led legislature since the late 80s has used our bank account as their own personal spending parade, if you will. We need to quit spending money on stupid stuff. And I want to preface that by saying, go look up the state's budget capital-wise and what went to each district, and you look to see what they spend money on. If we're going to spend public money, it should, one, employ Alaskans and be of lasting public value, and I don't see that happening. And that we need to start saving.
Patricia Faye Brazil is also running for the House seat in District 10.
I think the most important thing for us gathered here as Democrats at this convention is that we are open, transparent, and inclusive. And that is also, throughout my campaign, I want our state government to be open, transparent, and inclusive. I want us to take back our economy for our people, for the needs of our people. And we can do this, but we're going to have to do it together. No matter what political stripe a person is, we all have very basic human needs. And we have the right to expect that those needs can be met.
Are there any particular steps that you think you could take in Juneau that would help assist with taking those steps?
I think that we have to talk across party lines. I think that there are good people in both parties, and we have to talk to all of them because we are all in this together. It's not going to be one side or the other. We are all in this together, and we don't have a lot of time. We really need to be working on these things now. I think that we have to be where we are in the moment, and I think that representatives and senators owe their allegiance not to a party but to the people they represent. And if I run for State House in District 10 as a Democrat, well, I'm not just going to be serving Democrats. I need to be able to talk to everyone in that district and find a way to serve all of them the best I can. And a party that does that to its elected officials is shooting itself in the foot. Well, I just think that we have to stick together and we have to talk about what our real needs are. And I think too often we get talking about ideologies, or we talk about the economy like it's something separate from us. But the economy is, how far do you live from a grocery store? Can you afford those groceries? Is there enough food grown in our state to feed people? That's just one thing. But there's education, which is critical. We have to rebuild our infrastructure because it's crumbling. It's been crumbling for about 30 years. And when I say infrastructure, I don't just mean the built environment. I'm also talking about our social infrastructure, the things that people need in order to have a healthy life and a healthy society.
So you're talking Medicare then, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It is not cost efficient the way we deliver medical care now. Not at all. And one of the things that I really want to look into, and I have already been looking into it, and I haven't come down to a conclusion about what the best thing is, but looking at how states can help with the cost of pharmacy drugs. We really need to look at that.
Well, a lot of other entities negotiate with the farmer. Canada did a pretty good job of keeping theirs down somewhat, better than us, actually. Mm-hmm. So you think that we as a state could negotiate with Big Pharma? And
I don't know that we can directly negotiate, but I think that there are some policies that we can enact that can assist in that. And there are other states who are doing things, and I haven't done a complete 50-state study yet. I'm not finished with it, but I have started it to see what states can do in terms of bringing those pharmacy costs down.
Dimitri Shane spoke about how the current system of employment-based financing of healthcare insurance premiums is a very difficult problem for business owners.
Thanks, Paul. My view that financially Alaska is in a very tough situation, and nationally we're in a tough situation. I am a business owner, and many business owners like myself have an issue being able to hire new employees and retain new employees just because of the cost of health care in our state particularly. Business owners like myself would like to start new businesses. We would like to expand our businesses. And a lot of our money is going to health insurance, and it's just becoming unsustainable. And also the state of Alaska has a budget crisis. That's 30% of our state budget is devoted to health care costs alone. So from those two standpoints, I think it's absolutely imperative that we move to a single-payer Medicare for All healthcare system. This will allow Alaskan businesses to hire more employees. Young business people like myself can start new businesses, expand their businesses, and Alaska can finally have a sustainable solution to our budget crisis. We would have more money for public education, renewable energy, economic development. All those things would benefit from a healthcare system that would be based on single payer and Medicare for all.
I want to ask a nuts and bolts question about the topic you just raised. It seems to me that here in America we have this healthcare system that is based on employers paying and employees paying into the healthcare system. But a single-payer system that was outside that would free up all the expenses that healthcare is currently dragging businesses down. So I would think that most businesses would embrace the idea of a single-payer system because they would no longer be burdened with needing to accommodate enough sales in order to pay for that overhead, a gigantic overhead expense, I would think.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. And just from a standpoint of a health insurance based system that's tied to an employer, it doesn't work. I used to be an accountant and a CPA, and I have seen this system fail numerous times over and over. And it simply fails from the standpoint that when someone is sick, they can't work. So having your healthcare system tied to employment, when it just obviously fails because the person that's sick to a large extent is simply not able to work and they lose their health insurance coverage. And the second part is, of course, that it is not a good system for an employer because health insurance premiums are constantly going up. It is essentially a tax. Health insurance, from an employer's standpoint, is an unpredictable tax that goes up every single year. The employers have to change health insurance plans over and over, employees are not happy with the changes, and they blame the employer for the increased deductibles and limits and et cetera. So it is not a good system for an employer, and I would bet money on it that most employers would welcome a single-payer Medicare for All system where it's a predictable rate that's charged, you know, every paycheck, perhaps.
Every paycheck, depending on your income level, and if your income level is high, you can pay a little bit more as far as that premium goes, whereas if your income level is really low, you'd pay down to nothing or nothing.
There's a variety of way of doing it, but I think essentially it would be probably a set rate, and it would go up or down based on, you know, if you make more in wages, you would pay more, but the rate, I would imagine, would be the same.
He also spoke about tax cuts, spending, and the national debt.
I think another issue, being a younger person myself, I see this runaway national debt as a problem. I feel that our folks in the federal government have really are putting younger people at a disadvantage because we're borrowing money from China to give out these tax cuts that we can't afford, that don't benefit us or don't benefit the general public or next generation of Alaskans or Americans. And we're borrowing money from China to give out tax cuts that don't benefit our economy at all. So I think there's a reckless thing to do, and we need to be more responsible with our tax policy.
Tax policy and spending policy, or just the tax policy?
Well, I think tax policy is part of spending policy. We shouldn't be borrowing money to give out reckless tax cuts. But more reasonable and controlled spending, I think, can also be beneficial.
So, assuming you make it to Washington as the replacement for Don Young, how would you go about implementing the post-Don Young era?
Well, there are a few things that I would want to make sure that we focus on. I would start with single-payer Medicare for All, because that means additional $5 billion into our state economy every single year. Single-payer Medicare for All would be the next pipeline, if you think of it. It would be bigger than the oil industry currently is. And then we would, I would work my hardest to make sure that we bring back federal funding. We need funding for roads, we need funding for renewable energy projects, and we need funding to diversify our economy, and that's what I would focus on.
The other congressional candidate, Elise Galvin's main issue was Don Young's retirement, but from there the conversation quickly went to health care.
I think that the most important issue is that we remove Don Young from his current office and let him go to retirement. I think most Alaskans are saying there's so many different issues that are making us feel angst here in Alaska. And
Don Young's the main one for you?
Well, that's why I'm running, right? I'm looking to change up many of the things that he has not been able to accomplish. I know that our number one issue in Alaska right now is our angst with regard to our economy, and what's blocking that up the most is the healthcare debacle that we have. I think everybody's feeling it. Everyone from folks at home to the business to even the public sector, we cannot budget because of it. The costs are soaring, and it has to be tackled today. It should have been tackled years ago. We should have fixed the Affordable Care Act. And instead of fixing it, we've made it even worse.
What's the fix?
Well, that's a good question. I think there's a lot of different choices for us, and we certainly have a model here in Alaska that's working well. We have Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium is delivering health care at half the cost, in fact, a little bit less than half, per person, per year. And the wellness is higher than other folks who are not within that system.
So in that model, how is the funding arranged?
Yeah, it's actually several revenue streams coming in. They have Indian health money, they have veteran care money, they have Medicaid and Medicare. And we know that we need to simplify the funding system because the funding streams are taking a lot of the dollars, just sorting that out. Is taking a lot of dollars away from healthcare.
So as far as the fix to the system, are we talking single payer, or Because you mentioned that that the model that you were embracing was the one where there were a bunch of revenue streams, including the federal government, the Veterans Administration, and the tribal corporation.
Yeah.
So is the fix just all about the money coming in, or what?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I think you've probably heard a lot of people talk about Medicare for all. I don't know if you've had to take your elder in to find a primary care physician. To take Medicare is impossible right now. I tried to get my grandma in a couple years back, and it was nearly impossible even then.
So you're not in favor of Medicare for all?
Well, what I'm in favor of is a system for Alaska that doesn't drive out all of our doctors.
You're running for U.S. Congress.
Absolutely.
Just Alaskans, or everybody?
Certainly everyone, but I think that we need to look at Alaska right now as at least an exception, because look, if we get Medicare for all here, we would drive out most of the physicians who are here. Medicare for all right now as it stands is not enough. We could talk about Medicaid for all. That's a little bit different. I think you're probably aware of the difference. And I don't think that Alaska can afford Medicare for all. We would end up not only being without physicians, but we would end up in a place where those physicians who will stay, there will be so few that we would never get in.
Well, you would be one of 435, counting the Senate, one of over 535. You think you're going to be able to convince Congress that Alaska should be treated special?
Well, we've done it before. I tell you what, I'm as tenacious as all get out. And if we're in a situation where we're not well, we need to ask for that. We have to make sure that every citizen in the United States has access to health care. And right now, because of our health care costs, not every Alaskan is getting access. And that's not okay with me. And yes, there's ways for us to get to simplifying our stream. I think it is important for us to look at our funding streams and simplify it. But in addition to that, we need to look at what models are working and figure out a way for us to start getting access to every Alaskan today. And that is not going to be rocket science, because we see the model here, like I said, if it's 51,000 in the Anchorage base plus what they're offering in rural Alaska, so that's many more thousands there, that's something for us to look at. And I know that it's already they're cooperating and coordinating quite nicely and partnering with the veterans. In fact, they're taking in 25% of their care. And so that says to me then there's probably some ways for us to get to the table. And the question is, what would Congress do then to ease that up? Well, it might be looking at the funding streams, like we discussed, Medicaid, Medicare. We know we have only a couple of the private providers here in Alaska. Why? Well, that's because they don't want to do business up here. They're not making enough profit. So we need to start talking about costs and figure out a way for us to perhaps have a much larger base of people buying insurance so that those costs go down. And I think that when we bring everybody to the table and say, okay, what model would work for all Alaskans?
So when you're talking about increasing the pool of, wouldn't the entire nation be a substantial increase in that pool?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. So you're now headed back to Medicare for all. And like I said, we may need to call it something else, because Medicare, that model as it is right now,
well, what could you call it to increase the pool to include all the American citizenry?
Yeah, I don't know what we would call it, but I can tell you that the dollars that's there right now for that isn't going to work. And we may have a Cadillac, not a Cadillac insurance, but we might need to talk about a hybrid insurance. So there may be those who will take a base insurance and then add more on to that. We may look at other countries that have done that, where they have hybrid systems. I'm not sure that we're ready right now to go into what some are calling socialized medicine, particularly if they do not come anywhere near the costs of what the physicians need in order to keep their office as it is right now. So we know that in Alaska, the Medicare payments, I'll keep this as simple as I can, they are so low that many physicians will no longer take in Medicare patients, and they want to. Physicians are just as frustrated in some cases as patients, because they would like to be able to deliver health care in a way that at least helps them subsist, helps them pay off their their bills from their education, and we need to make sure that this is right.
Why is it that Alaska charges for physician care exceed the ones down in the lower 48?
Well, the cost of living up here is higher. That's one of the reasons. But I think another important reason is that we have a system here that is per care. So if they, no matter what it is that they're getting, they charge for it. And that, instead of it being per diagnosis, it's per care. And that can be, in some cases, I think exorbitant.
Could you explain that a little bit better? I'm not sure.
Yeah,
I know what you mean.
Sorry. So the insurance company, the way that they operate is that if you were to walk into the office and you've got a cold, then you get that the insurance company is going to give to that physician a certain amount of money, and that's a flat fee. And in Alaska, it's a much lower flat fee. Or sorry, in Alaska, it tends to be a little bit higher than the rest of the nation, but it still doesn't cover all of the costs that the doctors have.
Because the cost of living is so high up in Alaska?
Yes, that's part of it. I think the other part of it is that there's a lot of other extra, let's call them add-ons. So if you were to come in and say, look, my arm hurts, and you end up getting x-ray, those costs end up being extremely high here. And I don't know if it's because they're bringing in the equipment or if it's because they're able to charge it, and so they do. I don't know. It feels like there's nobody who's really kind of looking over what those extra costs are. But I don't think that the physicians are pocketing that extra dollar. I really don't. I think that it's big pharma, and I think it's the extra side costs of any kind of diagnostic work that happens for us. So part of it might be that we're going to have to be able to give up a little bit of those extra pieces. I know that oftentimes when I go in for something, they say, well, let me get you in for an MRI. And, you know, that's like $1,200 later. And I never know that it's going to be $1,200. I never know exactly what percentage of that I'm going to have to pay, because I can't tell if it's in-network or out-of-network. The whole business is just completely a racket, and it's not transparent.
I want to try to finish up, wrap this up, with your view of how the funding is going to, in your idealized world of a healthcare system that you could design, mm-hmm. where's the money going to come from? Is it going to come from the paychecks of the employees, or could you just explain that?
Well, I think it's not going to be, I guess what I want to make very clear to you is that I don't think we're going to be able to do any of this tomorrow. We're going to move into my ideal world in time. It's going to be steps. So I would like us to start with looking at the costs and what that costs of our particular procedures are. I think they're a little out of whack. I think that the care for an individual visit is fine, but when you look at the cost of all of the extras, it's out of whack. When you look at the cost of pharma, it's totally out of whack. And there must be a way for us to, you know, look, we can only charge so much for electricity. How did we end up charging whatever we want to charge for any kind of medicine? And why is it that the person who lived next door is paying $3 a pill when I'm paying 20 cents a pill? If there's no way for us to navigate that, it is completely hidden from the consumer. So I would start by saying that we need to be more transparent for consumers. Now, when we talk about funding streams and what it's going to look like, the main thing I'm going to tell you is that we need to simplify it. Right now, what we have is too many people getting in the back room working on how you code that particular doctor's visit, or how you code the amount of time that you spend in the hospital. And what's happening is that all of that energy is going there into these insurance companies or into what we're calling, I think we've talked about, Medicare, Medicaid, and the energy is not getting into, and the dollars aren't getting into patient wellness. And that's where our focus needs to be.
Okay, so we just heard from two candidates that are going up against Don Young, Dimitri and Elise. And they both highlighted the healthcare system as something that they see that needs to be worked on. Did you see any difference in the way that they were presenting their ideas, or what did you see when you heard what they were talking about?
Well, when Dimitri talked about single-payer system Medicare for all, it was pretty much structured the way by Bernie Sanders is talking about him. Talking about healthcare. And one of the things that Dimitri said that struck me, which is something I believed in a while, is what a burden it is on businesses to have employees pay for, both the employee and the employer pay for their health premiums. And that has to come out of their pockets. And that's a cost of doing business, an enormous burden of doing business. Yeah,
and the other point he made was that it's an unknown cost, because the expectation is it'll go up every year, but they're never sure how much it'll go up.
So, with this current system, yeah, their premiums are going up all the time.
Right.
And benefits are being reduced all the time.
Correct.
Yeah. Now, with Elise, she was reluctant to share with us how she felt that the funding was going to occur. And one of the things that I noticed about her in her description of Medicare as opposed to Medicare for all was that Medicare as it currently stands is not a system that she appreciates. Her experience of it has not been good. A lot of horror involved in that. But I think when she was talking about Medicare for all, she was equating the two. Medicare for all, single payer, would be an entirely new system for America. You wouldn't have the same structure at all as we're currently experiencing. And I didn't think she was able to understand that they're basically two different systems. She was using the phrase Medicare in its pejorative sense and applying it to the future, which we don't really know how it's going to be put together.
But she did make the point that we don't know what we'll call it. And what I appreciated that she had to say, too, was this idea that we have to look at several different prongs to this problem. So the idea of a healthcare system for everyone is certainly a part of that. And then she makes a point about the cost of medical treatment. And certainly when we look at that, and we've all experienced this, if we've been to multiple doctors in different states or talked to other people, their cost of care, we know that those costs vary greatly. And I think she's making a really good point. Why isn't an aspirin here cost the same amount as an aspirin over there? And because it's not a transparent system, we can't even make those comparisons. So I think that's another problem that she's saying has to be tackled. And then the third thing that I think she was getting at with the native healthcare system in Alaska is this idea of wellness. And other countries use that model too, where it's not just a caring system for people because they're sick, but it's how do we care for people to keep them well?
Well, I agree. We can.
And she just touched on that, but I think that that's another part of that, you know, kind of multi-prong approach that, you know, it's a real shift in thinking.
Oh, I think it's been talked about for a while in the past that we need to do preventative care as opposed to just going to the doctor when we're sick.
And, you know, again, with a lot of healthcare insurance policies or that sort of thing right now, it's interesting that they will not provide preventative types of care.
Well, some do, some don't.
Precisely. Yeah. And, you know, so that takes us away from that, thinking that wouldn't it be better to prevent things than to have to spend a lot in treating it down the road?
Yeah, I think that can be worked on. But I was pretty much interested, and I think you could tell from the interview, trying to pin at least down on where the funding would come from. You know, her reluctance to call it socialized medicine, Medicare for all, didn't really address the issue of where is this going to come from. Is it going to continue to come from the paychecks of the employees and the employer contributions, or are we going to have a bigger pool, including all the American citizens, that would balance that out?
I'm just happy that we're having this conversation on a national level. When you think about even 20 years ago that, you know, this was such a taboo kind of topic that, you know, as people are pushing it out there and there's a lot more support for universal health care, both candidates are saying there's models out there. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. We can look at how other countries are doing it and pick the best.
And where it works.
Correct. And, you know, along with all those other things that have to be thought about, the costs of health care and really promoting wellness in the population.
The elephant in the room that many people choose to ignore because we're supposed to be on it at this point in our civilization was eloquently expressed by Lynette Cooper.
As I said before, Paul, I think one of the really big issues that really doesn't get discussed a lot, but it's always in our face every day, is racism in this country. It's a problem that we've had to deal with for a very long time. Me being a person of color, you know, I see it a little bit differently than other people. It's something that's always there. It may not be in the forefront, but it's always there underneath everything that's going on. I think, as I had mentioned to you before, I don't think this country has really ever seriously addressed the racial problem here. I mean, we kind of tap dance around it with, you know, marches and discussions and things, but nothing's really been addressed. When you look at other countries around the world, Rwanda, South Africa, Germany, those countries have really taken on their racial issues head on. In Germany, it's illegal to be a Nazi. I mean, they have memorials to the Holocaust victims there, so they really take it on and want people to learn about, you know, that terrible part of their German history so it can't be repeated. Rwanda, South Africa, as I said, South Africa, they created the Reconciliation Committee back years ago, and the Truth of Reconciliation. And so that kind of took on a lot of the problems that they had to deal with. I mean, still today they have issues dealing with it. Everything wasn't resolved with the Truth of Reconciliation, but it was an honest attempt to at least address the issues and try to give people a little bit of closure, if you will, you know, regarding, you know, that time in their history. But there's still problems. But at least the government and the people did seriously take the issue head on. Here, we haven't really done that.
It seems to me, looking at it from a historical standpoint, that we went through all the civil rights movement in the 60s and the 70s, losing Martin Luther King to an assassin, losing Malcolm X to an assassin. And it seems like we were moving along where people were generally had the feeling that, okay, we've addressed it, you know, we've had the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and everything. But then after Obama became president, it really seemed to me that there was just a opening of wounds.
There was, seriously, there was a big rollback, if you remember, on the Voting Rights Act. And Alaska, I was surprised to find out that Alaska was actually one of the states that was included in that voting rights. And 75 was amended to include Alaska, so there were problems even here.
And I think that had a lot to do with the natives at that point, yeah.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, it's not just, you know, a black-white issue. It's a white and people of color issue, you mm-hmm. know, whether it's Native Americans, Black Americans, Latino Americans. You know, we have this problem. As you were mentioning about the civil rights and the voting rights, with Obama being elected, that opened a whole floodgate with the voting rights. I was just reading about that, about how many states started coming up with so many rules and regulations and hoops that you had to jump through just to vote. You know, since they weren't being held accountable under the Voting Rights Act anymore, they could do whatever they want. And so you started seeing the creation of all these. You had to have a photo ID, and in Texas, you could use a gun license to vote, but you had to have certain you had to get special voting licenses, you know, or permission rather.
It seemed to me like the whole voting ID thing was designed to suppress the vote. I don't have any problem with presenting an ID. But if you didn't have the proper ID, like, for instance, students, their student ID was not good enough, then that just seemed to me designed.
The problem was they were creating rules for laws for a problem that didn't exist. We don't have a problem with voter fraud in this country. And when you look at the penalties, that's a federal offense. You know, you can go to prison for 5 years. How many people are going to risk that just to vote?
Mm-hmm.
Not many.
Just to do an extra vote.
Exactly.
In a poll of millions of votes.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that problem just really doesn't exist in this country. So they were just creating rules basically, you know, just to prevent people from voting. And there are so many stories, you know, out there about people that have been prevented, you know, from voting. And in effect, they've come up with new poll taxes where you have to have a birth certificate, but you have to pay to get your birth certificate. So if you're a limited income, you know, and you had to pay $40, $50 to get that birth certificate, and then you have to find a way to get to the polling place. And in a lot of places, they've shut down polling places. Arizona, they shut down about 70 of their polling places, and people are standing in line 4 to 5 hours waiting to vote, you know. So, and that's been repeated all across the country, you know. And so it's really only gotten worse, you know.
Well, with Trump's emergence as a candidate, it seemed to me that that kind of opened the floodgates for people who had racial feelings to just say, well, this is my man because he's expressing how I feel.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It seems like he gave him permission to just come out of the woodworks. You know, it's open season now. People are free to do whatever they want. I mean, every day we're seeing something. I mean, just on the news today, you know, there was another case with a lawyer in New York City that was upset because two people were speaking Spanish, you know, and you know, people are just totally out of control with it, you know. And as a person of color, we always know that's been there. The changing thing now is that there's social media and everyone has a cell phone, and these things are being filmed now. But these incidents have always gone on, whether it's been police violence against people of color or, you know, just all kinds of things. We're still dealing with redlining, with the banks discriminating against people of color, you know, just all sorts of things, you know, affecting everyday life for people of color, whether it's the education problem, mass incarceration. I mean, these things are all still relevant issues today, and people don't like to talk about that. They think, oh, you know, you start talking about slavery and that happened, you know, hundreds of years ago. It has nothing to do. It does have something to do with today. It hits us in the face every single day. As I said, when you're dealing with economics and education, those things are the people of color are still getting the short end of those things, you know. I mentioned to you before, there's a new museum down that just opened down in Montgomery, Alabama, the Peace and Justice Museum, and that museum is dedicated to lynching. No one's ever talked about lynching much in this country, you know, but this museum, that's what it's focusing on. I mean, there's a really long history in this country where lynching was thought of something that was, you know, a fun thing to do. I mean, newspapers would take out full-page ads letting you know when the lynching was going to occur. People would have picnics, you know. School would shut down for the day. They'd pull kids out of school to go to the lynching. You know, you can still see postcards today that are out there, postcards that people would buy and send to their relatives across the country showing a body hanging with the little kids playing and, you know, having ice cream and chicken under the hanging body. And it's like, what does that do to a people? What did that do to those kids that were there? Those kids had to grow up, you know, and deal with that. So were they permanently scarred for life? Did they accept that as the norm? Or, you know, did they rebel against that, you know, in some kind of way? But the fact is, those kids are still out there today. They're walking around today. They've grown up and they're in society, you know, and they brought those ideas, you know, with them, you know, into their everyday life. And that's just transferred into society, you know, at large. So, you know, we still have a lot to deal with.
So Jim Crow went underground exactly. After the 60s, but Trump brought him back to the forefront.
Exactly. It's always been there. As I say, just in different forms, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, we still deal with the same issues, you know.
This has been a special edition of Bridging the Gap, coverage of the Alaskan Democratic Convention. Thanks for listening.